Okay, thank you for the production. I here show the first layer, the joint pictures. One row is computational, one row is experiment. You can all guess which row is computational. We could make it even less noisy if we spent a little bit more time on that. And that is here, the joint work we did over the past years with the many colleagues, many of whom are here. We did bosons and fermions. Some colleagues did the experiments. I didn't. I did the simulations. So it was actually mostly the Paulette, who is here, who did most of the simulations for the bosons and some for the fermions. The other important people to mention is Nick. By Boris, Nicole is here. Boris will come next month. And the experiments on the bosons were done by the group of Immanuel Bloch, who at that time was still in Mainz. And a few people he moved, like Lode, moved during the course of the project from ETH to UMass to Harvard and back to ETH. Then we did some simulations of your fermions. That's harder when it's more methods, so it's more people. And I'll mention who did what when we get to the various parts there. And there we compared to some data by the group of Tillmann and Esslinger. Now the problem of working with bosons with Immanuel and fermions with Tillmann is that Tillmann will not tell us what he does with bosons, and Immanuel will not tell us what he does with fermions.
But Matthias, yes. Phillips tells us both what he does with bosons and with fermions. And he also has an optical lens.
So we should talk more to you.
Well, we don't yet do things with fermions, but we will soon. But yeah. We do lots of stuff
things
with bosons.
Thanks, bosons, yes. So now, what do we use? We use the supercomputer, and there's been a huge progress there, and that's also a part of the reason for the other program. There is an exponential growth in the speed of the fastest machine in the world. This here is the 500th fastest, that also grows exponentially. And this is the sum of the top 500, and that also grows. And there's a slightly more growth in the faster machine, but it's all exponential. Still, although Moore's law has problems, but one can still pack more CPUs into machines. One can still make them faster. It gets much harder to program them, though, because if you look back at about 1990, machines had about 10 CPUs, so like your PCs now. If you look at the year about 2000, machines had 1,000 CPUs. If you look at the current machines now, they have 100,000 CPUs. And the plans are for 2018 to have a machine that reaches an exaflop with 10 million CPUs. That means it gets just much harder to program those machines. But of that increase, it increases by a factor of 1,000 in a decade. A factor of 100 of the 1,000 is due to having more CPU cores. Which means if you don't make your programs parallel, you will only gain a factor of 10 and not a factor of 1,000 over 10 years. That means we have to think about new methods that scale well. And that's also one thing we should discuss at the program. If you don't invent new algorithms, then you will not reach that scaling, but a slope that's a factor of 3 less. The other thing, with a delay of about 13 years, all of those machines become your desktop machines. So if you think that doesn't concern you yet, in 5 years you will have 1,000 cores on your desktop. So that's the challenge one has on the computational side. That was just a side remark. But despite this exponential growth, we still cannot solve all quantum anybody problems, simply because that is an exponentially growing problem as well, because the Hilbert space grows exponentially in many cases, which means we can only linearly increase our system size, maybe 2 more atoms every 5 years. That will not really help us, and so there's the need to find better hardware, that scales better than this. Although it will be a challenge to beat those machines with quantum hardware. But still, we have some problems we can't solve yet, like the superconductors. We can't really model them yet accurately. We can simplify them to simply model like the Hubbard model. We still can't solve it yet, although we are making progress. And the big help, and that's now the joint aspect of the talk, is that the optical lattice systems allow us to build a quantum simulator, as you know, that one can use to test ideas on those simple models. We can actually realize the simple models. We can simulate them. We can compare. And if that works out well, then we can invent new methods or use the quantum simulators to tackle the real materials in the future. So that's the vision. Now, I don't think you have to say more or much here about the optical lattices. I had some nice pictures in here that I skipped, pictures of the Nobel laureates like Bill Phillips and others. But since he's here, we don't have to show that. We take bosons at low temperatures. We take an optical lattice. We realize the Hubbard model. Now we have a Hubbard model of bosons, of fermions, of mixtures in 2D, 3D, 1D, whatever. It is well controlled. We look at our lattice. We describe it just by the hopping T between the lattice sites. We have an energy U when it's doubly occupied. It is well controlled. We can change the amplitude U, the hopping T. Can make the super lattices whatever we want. We can have bosons, fermions. It's just great. We can realize any model we want. And that's the goal. And so we can use them as quantum simulators for the Hubbard model and solve hard problems there. Now, what I do, I don't go into the lab. I don't have lots of lasers. I don't have the money for it. I use the money to buy a big cluster. And on that big cluster, which is still cheaper than an optical lattice experiment, although actually buying the machine and with all, it's comparable in cost. We did do the math.
Lose many atoms.
Yeah. So we did do the math that the computational group costs as much as the next experimental one. So it's not that cheap. But we have methods at the moment which, for the currently accessible optical lattice experiment, we can model all the relevant details and perform accurate simulation of the whole setup at the temperatures and system size and all that you can do in the lab. We can simulate that in a controlled way with essentially no approximation. And we can use it for a few things, and that's what I want to show today. We can use it to validate and to calibrate experiments. Now, that's a big change from what we usually do. Usually, one uses experiments to validate a theory. Here, we go the other way. We use simulations on a model to validate experiments, because those experiments are supposed to realize a Hubbard model. And we know about the Hubbard model, so they should better agree with what we calculate. If not, the experiment has a problem. That's really nice for a change. The other thing is we can calculate much more than the experiment can measure, and we know more. We know our temperature, for example, and so we can provide some the reference data for thermometry, the quantities to compare to when you want to get the temperature. And then it is very easy for us to realize the new system. We can easily change our couplings, build new probes that goes much faster than in the experiments. And that way we can you test new ideas for probes or for the thermometry before someone spends here in the lab to build it? And finally, we can go to lower temperatures and bigger systems than the experiments, and we can show what you will see when you cool it down further, when you reach the nail state and so on. So what I want to claim as a statement here to inside discussion is that for a system, both for boson and fermions, we are more accurate than the objective experiment at the moment. We have a race going on. Who will be able to lower the temperature faster? And so far, I at least claim that we're winning. But of course, the hope is that at some point we'll not manage anymore, and then the quantum gear simulators will help us. So we want to simulate the experiment. And there are a few issues here to consider. The first is we need a model. And that's actually a tricky thing where there are some open questions. But when we have a deep optical lattice, it's no problem. We take the Hamiltonian of the system. We have the atoms here. We have the kinetic energy of the atoms. We have the optical lattice potential. And we have the interactive action term parameterized by the scattering length. What we do then, okay, so we have the mass of the rubidium atoms we know. The scattering length has been measured as well, so we know the coupling constant. The laser amplitude we're given from the experimentalists. The waste of the laser beam as well, and the trapping potential. And the wavelength of the laser light is known as well. So we know all the inputs. But we don't want to solve this problem. We want to map it to a simpler model. And so we first map it to a Hubbard model. And in a deep lattice, that is this reliable mapping. We look at the Vanier functions of the atoms in the optical lattice, look at the Vanier function of the lowest band. Then we calculate the Hopping terms, T, the interaction U, and we have the trapping potential V. And that way we then can do an ab initio mapping of the original full many-body continuum model to a lattice problem. There's a big difference to materials. In materials, we also know the microscopic model. It's just Coulomb and the atoms sit around. But it's a horribly complex Hamiltonian with long-range forces and the nuclei and the inner shells and so on. And so to model even a simple material like silicon, you need about a 20 or 30 band model. For harder ones, for the cuprates or for the actinides, lanthanides, it's 50s and 100s of bands. So here we have the big advantage. We can do ab initio simulation, can map the full quantum problem to a simple one band model. Mm. In the materials, we can't do that yet. And so here we can really compare directly, and that's the great things about the optical lattices, that they give us our models in a clean way.
Yes. What's the correction to these models?
I was just coming to that. That's a very good question. The correction to these models was investigated in a nice paper by Hans-Peter Büchler. At least some of the corrections. The first thing is we want to go into a deep lattice where we have a one-band model. The moment you go to a two-band model, it becomes important that you know more about your interaction than just the scattering length. So the second approximation is that the interaction is sufficiently accurately parameterized just by the scattering length. The moment you want to go beyond that, the moment you want to take into account corrections beyond just the scattering length approximation, or the moment you want to take into account higher bands, things become non-universal. Mapping then really depends on the details. you could now, for example, assume that you want to calculate the exact interaction potential of rubidium atoms, of two of them. And we could calculate that from quantum chemistry methods. Now that immediately leads to huge problems, because the main problem it will lead to is that the interaction potential is essentially Leonard Jones, with a minimum at a distance of a few angstrom, which is about a factor of 1,000 smaller than your wavelength. So that means that in order to resolve that, you need features in real space that are about a factor of 1,000 finer than your lattice. So you need to go to about the 1,000th band in order to, and that's where the interaction will be strongest. So you immediately need to take into account about thousands of bands. So it's very hard to actually go beyond that to a multiband model. That's one big challenge. We have some ideas of how we can do that in a shallow lattice. For now, I think the accurate mapping is really restricted to a deep lattice where it's enough to look at the lowest bands. Once you include higher bands, it just becomes fitting. What Hans-Peter Büchler proposed to improve on the U is to essentially solve the scattering problems of two atoms in the lattice and solve the same scattering problem in the Hubbard model and match the two. And that way one can get a better mapping between U and the scattering length in a not so deep lattice. But the moment it becomes important to take into account the second band, this mapping is essentially over. So that's why we restrict ourselves so far now to deep lattices where it's enough to look at the one band model. Next year I can tell you about many bands.
So yeah. Yes, when you say taking into account the second band, you mean like a second band for a second two band Howard model, or the second band just for virtual processes to renormalize U and T and so on and so forth?
Even to renormalize the U and T through real processes to second band, you first need microscopic Hamiltonian with the interaction that mixes the two bands. Where do you get the term from? You can do some fitting, the one thing, but if you want to calculate it ab initio from the real rubidium potential, then actually you find that the biggest U terms will be in band number 1,000, because that's what resolves the Leonard Jones potential. So you need to immediately go to hundreds of bands. And, or one does some fitting, but if we fit, then we just take some effective one-band model and it works again.
You're saying hundreds of bands or thousands of bands, but why don't you just change bases? I mean, I don't understand why you would stay in the same basis if you have to use 100 bands.
You can always map it to an effective one-band model if you have few atoms in it. Mm. But where do we get the effective one-band model from? We can get it from a microscopic Hamiltonian. We can now try to actually say, okay, I make an ansatz for a one-band model, and I make that ansatz as a Hubbard model. And I assume just an answer, you know the nearest neighbor V, no T prime, no nothing. And then I solve the two-body problem of my atoms in the lattice. And I match the results for two particles. And that allows me to fix a T and a U. If I want a V and a V prime and a T prime in addition, I need to solve more problems. But by solving the full problem for a few particles, you can map it to a one-band model.
But is your argument that you know, any consideration of P and D bands are just, you know, just useless? Is that, it sounds like you're saying that. A lot of people are doing that, so it's a strong statement.
You can do it. You will just not be able to derive from first principles in an easy way the effective model, the effective U-band model that describes it.
But numerically, if you explore parameter space, the experiments then can then go and actually fit the interactions, et cetera.
You can fit it, yes.
Okay,
yes.
So
you can fit it.
It's useless, you just say you can't get it from first principle.
The crucial word here is ab initio. If you want to have ab initio, then you have problem.
Exactly.
If you want to have some effective thing which works well to describe your...
That can be done, yes.
That can be done,
yes.
And even you have some intuitions what the values and dependencies of these parameters are.
Right. Okay.
Yeah. No, and you can calculate. You just have to take into account count hundreds of bands, and then in principle it can be mapped to one band model. And one could do it. It's just tough. Yeah.
You said that if you want to do more bands,
yep.
then you need to know more about the scattering
yes.
and the scattering length. Mm-hmm. I certainly agree that if you wanted to put in the full interatomic potential,
yes.
then you would have to, in order to express the things that are going on there, you'd need a lot of bands.
Yes.
But what I don't see is, if I just wanted to put in, say, the first excited band, the yeah. B band, why would I necessarily need something beyond the scattering length to do that?
I just don't have a way how you can calculate the how you can calculate from first principle what is your effective model that describes your system.
Something that would map into something as simple as a Bose-Hubbard
yes.
model.
Exactly. I can write it down, but I have to fit it to your data to get the numbers. I can't predict what the couplings will be. I can guess what they might be roughly, but I can't predict what the value is. So I can't really test that you've really built my model.
Why bother writing down an effective model at all? Why not just work in real space directly with the real Coulomb potential? And then you don't have thousands of bands, then you're just working in real space.
Okay. So you want to take your helium code, for example, which does Leonard Jones, right? And you can apply it, but now, think about it, you want to look at systems that are a millimeter in size nearly. With you, and then you need really, really tiny time steps. And, right? Because it floats around for a long time and there are huge barriers in between where you have to tunnel through. So that's one thing we do actually for the bosons now, but not with the real potentials because they're just so short range that it becomes hard. But it's still much, much, much slower than simulating the Hubbard model. Okay, so the one-band model in a deep lattice where we know it's a one-band model and the higher bands are not important, except to correct the U, that's what we can do. When we really populate the higher bands, then we can't predict. Equilibration is an open issue, I think, for the experiment. We assume that it's in thermal equilibrium. That's not always the case. The comparison can be used to check that. So there are some open issues here. But now let's look at the one-band model. And I think we all have heard about the Bose-Hubbard model. Is there anybody here who has not seen the Bose-Hubbard model? Then let me skip that, because we spent a lot of time discussing. And there's a beautiful movie I got from Manuel Bloch's group about what one does when one sees the time of your the flight images. One gets the cloud of atoms, drops it down, shines light onto it, and then takes a picture. And I show that because I'll come back to that later.
So can you get down faster than you know? Can you be faster than? Oh, I'm just kidding.
Can we be faster than experiment? In what? In dropping it?
You're running a computer and he's running the analog.
I'll come to that.
It depends on whether you count the time it takes to set up the experiment.
But then you also count the time it takes to build the machines and write the software. Just in running time. Just in running time, I'd say it's comparable.
I know.
You need maybe a minute for a shot. You need a few hundred shots, so you need a few hours to run for the simulation. If we use a single core, it takes about 10 hours for a single point. We might need a few. We have a big cluster, can be cut down to a few hours, so it's the same. Within one day, both can be done. But then, when you look at the noise, you can guess which one is experiment and which one is the simulation. And I'll let you guess, and that will tell you the answer. Because we can reduce our noise by increasing the time. So we get the momentum distribution, and that is the famous picture. You will know from the Georg Kreiner paper, but now tell me please where here happens the quantum phase transition from the condensate to the mod insulator. At which picture does it happen? So that was beautiful and qualitative, but for a quantum simulator, for something that solves a model, we want to have it more quantitative. And that's the challenge, because we in simulation can do that easily without a problem. It takes 50 hours, but can we actually do it also for the experiment? And that's where the validation comes from. Can we try to do it in the experiment and then then check that with the simulation? And we use the Worm algorithm, which I will not talk about in detail here because I think there have been many talks about that. If you want to hear about it, talk to Nikolai. He invented it. It's a very simple idea that can be explained in 5 minutes. And if someone wants to learn about it, we can have an informal talk here sometime. We can easily do in about half a day, half a million atoms on a lattice of 200 cube sites. So it's the same system size as in experiments, the same particle numbers. We can easily do more. We don't do more just because the experiments can't do more yet. And the timings are similar.
Of course, Matthias, you have to tell us the temperature, right?
The same temperature as the experiment. We can go to lower temperatures, and it will take more time. The time will increase linearly with inverse temperature. The time will increase roughly linearly with the volume. But we have about 10,000 CPU cores, so it's absolutely no problem for bosons. And then we can model the accurate model we got. We use the same system size, the same particle number, the same temperature. And we can measure the same quantities as observed in the experiment. And the question is the experiment correct? Now let me show the first 3D in situ density images of a Bose-Hubbard model. At small u over t, with just a nice fuzzy big cloud. When we increase u over t, we go towards the critical point. It forms a mod insulator in the center. When we increase it more, at the u over t of 50, we have a mod plateau. Nice, when you can see the density profiles seem to get sharper, the cloud gets sharper. That's what you should see if you can look at it in situ in a 3D density image. Now, we can do more. We can simply slice it, and we can look at a cross-section. If I do that on my desktop machine, I can take a slice here, can slide it through, and that changes in real time. It needs a fast graphics card, but we can do it. When we increase the u over t, we get to the critical point. We start forming something that is flat in the middle. When you go into the mod phase, it's a nice plateau in the center. We can look at the density directly. I want to see those pictures also from experimentalists in 3D. And then we can again compare. We can look at the cloud, and we can drop it and see how it expands. And that's how it looks like the first 3D time of the flight image on my desktop. I can take that, rotate it. I could make a movie now when you fly around it and see it. So it's not only cross-section we see, but the real full 3D thing. And we can also look at cross-section and see sharp peaks. So we have nice pictures that you can make, but we can also compare numbers.
So one question there. So that picture you get, like you take one quantum Monte Carlo shot, and then you just do evolution with non-interacting particles. You use something.
Yeah. That's how that was done. Yeah.
So it's really a momentum distribution.
No, sorry. This is not one shot, because in one shot we cannot measure the momentum. The real space the images are one shot. The momentum space images are averaged.
Right, but you have a patch. Each time you take a shot and then you just expand it.
And yes, okay, and yes.
That's one shot.
Yes. One shot at a time, but then it's averaged.
I think when you have just one shot, your image should look like the experimental image with the shot noise.
Yeah. No. Yes. So
like you exclude even the detector noise.
So we cannot do the momentum space image with a single shot in this code.
Right.
Because when we take one shot, we localize the particle first in real space. So we have the particles localized in real space, and when we then expand it, then it's not the same as you do. We can get the expectation values of what your mean picture should look like, and we can calculate the variance around it, and then one could create shots from that with noise.
Average of about 50,000 atoms, you should have the ensemble average just intrinsically as we have.
You don't do particles.
Yes.
Yeah. We do some lines in imaginary time.
Yes.
They're not particles.
Okay. We can look at one time slice, but this is then that first we localize the particles, we measure them in real space, and then expand them, and that's different.
But the expansion.
Yes.
What you're really doing, if I've understood correctly, is you're telling us what the momentum distribution is of the atoms in the lattice. Is that correct?
Almost. What is the momentum distribution corrected for finite time of flight?
There's no hydrodynamics or anything, no finite state interactions in there. Which in the experiments
In the lattice experiments, no. You have the lattice. These are localized one-year functions. The gas starts expanding, doesn't interact until it's really much bigger. And by that time, it's so diluted that the
interaction
effects don't matter.
Interactions during the expansion.
Yes.
It's one of our big problems.
In the lattice experiments.
Yes. Only really very deep in 1D, then you can forget it. And all the other things you have.
And part of the atoms are delocalized if you have super fluid fractions. So.
But it's a low density.
Well, especially in 3D, it's a real problem.
Yeah.
It becomes less of a problem in
lower
other
in
lower dimensions, but it's definitely a big problem. It's one of the things we struggle with.
If you have a look, for example, at the expansion images that come out of the cesium experiment, where they can switch to the zero actually of interaction in Fishback resonance before they expand, and they're quite different to what happens when you have interaction during the time of flight. So in those experiments, actually, you have nice Fishback resonances, then you can get these sorts of images much more nicely by switching those interactions off during the expansion.
Hey.
We
have to talk about that later.
But you do have a finite time of flight correction.
That's
the fact that
and that's a huge correction.
It's not infinite.
Yes.
It's in there. So that gives you things like the initial size
And that's really important. If you don't do that, then the pictures will just not agree. That was the first problem.
And just as a matter of experimental, typical experimental fact, the interactions are usually at least as important as the finite size, which is to say finite time of flight.
Okay, let me continue. So we want to measure the temperature as a function of the U in the Hubbard model at unit filling. And the first problem is that we want to, since we have a trap, we want to define what we mean by unit filling. We mean it's unit filling in the center where the trap is flattest. Now we want the experiment to have a system which at TC has unit filling in the center. And so if you could measure the density in 3D in the trap center directly, then you could do that, since that's not possible yet. What we do is that we in Monte Carlo calculate what the total particle number should be so that you have that density, and the experiment can then aim for that density which we know gives you unit filling. So there's one challenge, still measure the density in situ in 3D. Then it can be more a simulator. The next problem then is we need to know the temperature. And I talk to many people in condensed metaphysics when they start doing ultra-cold atoms. They still think that it's just a canonical ensemble like in condensed matter that the temperature stays constant, then I have to remind people that these systems are isolated systems, not in contact with the heat bath. And so when one changes the lattice depth and coupling and so on, it's not the temperature that stays constant, but ideally, if you do it slowly enough, it's the entropy that stays constant. And that's what one has to remind oneself every day again, that it's different than condensed matter physics. And there are big changes. For example, often I'm told by people that this ground state phase should be easy to see because there's a big gap. That doesn't matter if you have a big gap. If you're not at a temperature below the gap, it doesn't help you. A big gap will not reduce the entropy of your state, for example. So here also, we need to know what is the temperature. And for that, ideally, we want to have a nice scheme for thermometry in the optical lattice that you could measure directly the temperature, which is not possible yet. What one can do is one can take the system before one loads it into the lattice, measures the momentum distribution there, matches that to a dilute Bose gas, and then one knows the initial temperature. From that one can get the initial entropy. And then we can calculate the entropy in quantum Monte Carlo in the optical lattice. That's a non-trivial calculation, because calculating the entropy is not like calculating the energy, but one has to do a thermodynamic integration, and that's what takes most of the time. We need to know the properties at many temperatures and not just at the target temperature. But then we can calculate the entropy, and then by saying if at first we had the temperature like here, for example, we have this entropy, we look in the optical lattice, that means we have a temperature of about 25 nanokelvin. And that way we actually compare things at constant entropy, but we often still plot it as a function of temperature. Although it might make more sense to plot it as a function of entropy. The next issue is the finite time of flight, when we expand it, and also what we took into account was the resolution of the camera, of the pixels there. And this is important. Let me quickly sketch that if you take your atoms, the sit, then the sites, you take the Fourier functions, you expand them. We look at the free expansion of the Fourier. And you have orbitals. And then we approximate the Fourier function by Gaussian. And we calculate what should be the final image that one sees in real space. And what enters there is the Fourier function and the Green's function in the lattice model. And if one does that calculation, then then what one gets is that the leading term is the momentum distribution, it's a Fourier transform, but there is a subleading correction to it. And if one takes that into account, that makes a huge difference in the pictures one sees. This is, in one case, that's a cut through a 3D system. This is what one should see in the momentum distribution function at infinite time of flight. This is what you would get at a time of flight of 100 milliseconds. Almost identical, but in 100 milliseconds, the atoms drop 5 centimeters, 2 inches, and they hit the glass, the walls of the vacuum chamber. What is typically done is something like 15 milliseconds. Then the peaks are substantially lowered. Look, that's a log scale here, and they are substantially broadened. If one were to drop it only for 3 milliseconds, then it's just totally smeared out. So one is lucky that with the times of flight that they use, normally one can see things nicely, but it would be much better if it could be a bit longer. Of course, when it's longer, the other problem is that the cloud gets bigger, the more dilute, and you can't really take a picture anymore. So there are the problems here, but what's done now is okay. And so, and here is a comparison now of the experiment and the Monte Carlo simulation. they were not on it exactly the same temperature, but we always matched it to find kind of the closest temperature that had the same entropy as the experiment. That's at the small value of U for the various temperatures, and the pictures look very similar, except that this one is a bit less noisy here. And when you look at profiles, then the agreement is very good. Now I wonder what the effects of interactions really are here for the rubidium. They don't seem to be large.
Or the deep lattice is kind of guaranteed to be small. That's what you used from the very beginning.
In a deep, yeah, but the question is, at which lattice will it start? Here, it's okay, it's deep.
You didn't have a slide, but there is an estimate that
yes.
It's approximately 1,000.
Yeah. So then one should see why in the other cases where one sees effects of interaction, what did it looks there. That's what one has to look at and then show that it works here. Have you done that yet, Lode? Looked at the cesium case, for example?
No. I never heard this remark before. The only thing I heard was from Kilo Stiftel, who said that you can see higher band effects. I never heard that the interactions would be big. Yeah. But deep lattices at these low densities, yes, because the maximum density is one. It's quite large. U and
the maximum is one.
It's one, yes.
It's not particularly low density.
There's one, and it's one atom in the site, and then the one here drops off exponentially.
But during the, I don't know about these specific ones, but certainly when we've estimated what the effects are, when you turn the lattice off suddenly, which is the way these things are done, then you have the atoms all interacting with each other very shortly after the lattice is turned off. You have essentially a cloud of atoms that are expanding, feeling the mean field of all the other atoms, and that mean field is not insignificant.
But we estimated that it was miserable. Just because, the atoms are flying with kinetic energy set by the deep lattice. And this kinetic energy, by definition of seeing one atom, is much bigger than U. So during the time of expansion, they cannot interact accumulate a big phase. So we estimated it to be
The central peak is the one that suffers the most from the interactions. Okay. But the other peaks, typically, we ignore the central peak for exactly that reason, because it's the one that's most affected. The other peaks, of course, they're moving out, but if you ask about what the relative motion of those things are, it's not entirely insignificant.
Well, we estimated at 5%,
It'll depend on the specific things, eight recoils isn't that deep, so.
We should check what we would get for your case and then see.
It depends on what the initial size of a whole sample because that may dominate the
effect. Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, yes, the regular world here has a temperature as well.
And yes.
So how did they do this? And they seem to get it right, more or less.
That is the temperature we estimated by assuming that the loading is adiabatic.
So you mean from the
calculated Bose-Einstein
condensate profile?
Yeah.
You adjust to Maxwell-Boltzmann, the thermal, and then
okay. When you go to deeper lattice, things don't look as good anymore. I don't want to hide that. I want to show that. And you see that actually this seems to fit more with this, and that picture more with this. So actually, it seems that the then look at the cross sections here, down here, and you see that here the peak in the experiment is lower than in the quantum Monte Carlo, and it fits more with the higher temperature. And again, here it fits more with that. So it seems that systematically we get pictures that correspond to higher temperatures when you go to the deeper lattice. And then deep lattice, the interaction effect should be less.
But it might be less likely to be adiabatic.
But it's probably less adiabatic, yes, correct. And so that's why we then said, look, we believe you have a heating problem here, that it's not adiabatic. And then we thought of at first, no, that was checked before. That's okay.
You cannot be sure that he has also. Sorry, just day. To.
Well, day. Everybody has a problem with adiabaticity.
Yes. And that's what I want to show, one thing that one can easily do.
Matthias,
yes.
Question, can you please go back? I mean, if I integrate that, it doesn't look that they have both the same number of particles.
You can't compare. It's, you know, it's
a cross section.
You can't compare.
Okay, but I mean, if I think that the same, it's not going to be then in the other direction,
right? It's the same number of particles.
Okay.
Yeah.
Because from that picture, it
yeah. That's
it's going to the other direction.
The cross section. You can get the full data, the 3D data from us, but you know, it's integrated only. So now, what was then done in the experiment? Is to increase the hold time in the lattice, just to estimate what is the effect that one gets just from holding it in the trap in the lattice. And one can then match the pictures to the Monte Carlo and see which temperature one gets or which entropy. And there is a beautiful linear increase of entropy over time. There's a linear heating. And the heating rate is quite substantial. And for this case, we get a heating of about 2 kb per second per particle. So the entropy goes up just rapidly. In about 100 or 200 milliseconds, it can nearly double. Here, for the Bose-Einstein condensate, you don't need such low temperatures. But if we then look at fermions at the nail state or the D-wave superconducting state, they have much, much lower entropies. And then that heating, if it is that big also for fermions, then that can be a real showstopper.
That heating is from the...
That heating is... That's what the paper by the Stierzoller group and
you're here.
Yes.
So these were not particularly... So these were lenses, I think, about 850 nanometers or so. So they weren't so far tuned back then that inherent scattering is the main thing. If you go to further tuned lattices, and you can cut that down somewhat.
Cut it down by a factor of 2 or 3.
It's not the deflectations of the coherent.
No, I mean here we could get.
You also get fluctuations from there.
So you also get. So there are other possible heating mechanisms where the amplitude fluctuations and phase fluctuations, which actually we're looking at now separately. But I think that here in this experiment, that most of that heating can be well explained by simply the incoherent scattering, spontaneous emissions.
Okay, but I want to make sure that I've understood because of what Jörg is asking. Spontaneous emission in the presence of a strong lattice can lead to more heating than you would have imagined if it was just that same amount of spontaneous emission with a very weak traveling wave, for example. That's what you're talking about, fluctuations of the dipole force.
Yeah, that's the question. And you need some beautiful laser cooling, all these experiments with the fluctuations of the dipole force.
Yeah, so, well, there's lots of people that have done these things. But the point is that if you just said, the heating is going to be one recoil per scattered photon, that won't necessarily capture everything that's going on in a lattice. So did your calculations include all of the features of that, or just sort of a free space calculation of the heat?
Okay, so this was all in the lattice. We included all of the incoherent scattering, which is sometimes referred to as a combination of dipole fluctuations and spontaneous emissions.
Okay, yeah.
Okay, and in fact, the rate with which the energy increases here, if you believe it fits to the Monte Carlo, is actually slower than you would expect if you just looked at the total energy input into the system. And we think that the reason why is because some particles are going to higher bands and then not thermalizing. However, we then have a large discussion here that actually the rate of energy increase as determined from the scattering processes is not really sufficient to describe what's happening for the many-body states. We need to ask how the many-body state has really changed here in terms of, say, the long-range order for the superfluid or the different properties of the mod insulator. And the bottom line here is that when we characterize heating in the superfluid, that what we get out is very similar to what they see here, simply describing the heating as due simply to these incoherent scattering processes.
Yeah. But now there's another issue that we worry about, and that is, as we turn the lattice on, mm-hmm. the rate at which the lattice is turned on may not be sufficiently yes, slow yes. to
that's
be
another problem, yeah.
to separate.
Yes, it is.
Okay.
Yeah.
And that's not included in the way.
It's not included here, but
this is just a static lattice.
This is right. static lattice.
Yes. Okay. Yes. That's the. When here one ramped it up and then just held it constant and waited. And it seems to be that hopefully the Bose condensate is the worst in this case, because here if you take the atom, you scatter it to your the higher band and it drops back down again, then it's localized, its phase is randomized, it leaves the condensate. That's not heating if you have the single atom, but in the condensate, that's the heating process. And that will not be there in the MOT insulator, so that should be better there deep in the MOT phase, for example. And it might be better in the metal or worse. I don't know. One has to look at that.
So but the, another question.
Yeah.
Sorry.
About Bose metal.
We first have to realize the Bose metal.
Yeah. So how many? What is the percentage of atoms that are lost during all this adiabatic? Because you know there are always all these thermal atoms that. Flying around, and then some of them will go to higher band that are on trap and so on.
I honestly don't know how many are lost over that time, but it could be measured probably. Do you know?
No. I think it's.
Do you know about how many get lost in half a second?
Well, it depends on the lattice.
That is, yes.
We, for a fairly large detuning in the most recent experiments mm-hmm. with the synthetic field, it's not that large, but it's larger than, it's bigger than. 50, you get a photon scattering every few seconds, mm-hmm. and the photon scatterings are pretty severe.
So then, yes, it was mentioned that detuning further can help, but detuning further also means that your hopping times go down, that the T becomes. So when you make the wavelength bigger of your lattice, when you detune further, the hopping goes down. And when you then actually calculate what happened, and that means that if you now look at what is the heating in units of the hopping time, then that does not go down forever, but that will be saturated sometime.
Okay, but you have to detune a lot.
You have to detune. So I think we estimated you have to detune about 100 nanometers, so then it saturates.
Really?
Because
yeah. I don't know. I guess I would have thought that
the heating per hopping time.
Yeah. But I guess I would have thought that the hopping time isn't going to change a whole lot, changing the wavelength from say 800 to 900 or something, right?
But like exponential functions.
Yeah, but that means to be tuned red, but it could also be tuned blue.
And then
the hopping time becomes shorter.
Then they become shorter, but you can't detune very far on the blue side.
No, but also your yeah. You are then sitting in a place where there's less light. So.
Yeah, but
I don't know how much is
less by doing that.
So in this particular case, if you look at the mean body effects in the superfluid state, if you do detune blue, then there is a significant reduction in the effective heating that you would see here. Yes, you'll get the same total rate of energy input into the system, but that would mainly be taken up with a few atoms going to higher bands. And you would actually see that in the blue detune case, just considering this heating mechanism, that in fact the superfluid state should be much more robust than the red detune lattice. So that was one of the key conclusions also of what we did. However, one then should ask about light assisted collisions, and there are other heating mechanisms here. And just as a side remark, we are looking into these things now. Fluctuations, classical fluctuations on the potential, light assisted collisions and these.
And we'd like to hear from you then, what is the best tuning on which side? It was the best one can get, right? That's what one wants to then have. Know at the end.
It depends on the many body state.
Yes.
Actually, I like the question. I believe your quantum Monte Carlo calculation is very accurate, but what is special of. So why the line recorded curve is so special?
It's technical.
Why is special? They believe there's some extra resonance there which they haven't identified yet. Did now what?
They found the extra resonance and not did.
Okay, the cure. Okay. This is not Monte Carlo data. This is experimental data. That's experiment, yes.
No.
We said, okay, do that, and you should see that there's heating. And they said, no, there's no heating. We checked it, and then when it was done, they said, oh, yes, interesting. And that's easy to do.
No, we simply help to calibrate the entropy. Yeah. The experiment is done as experiment.
But with the
calibrated
yes.
It's in reasonable agreements.
Okay. Effect of two, so you said. In the front. Yeah.
Now, with respect to this issue of detuning to the red, mm-hmm. so that the lattice gets bigger and the tunneling goes down.
Yes.
What would be the disadvantage of then compensating for that just by reducing the lattice depth a little bit?
Yeah. So
the same tunneling.
We took the equations from their paper and we looked at, you take the Hubbard model and they want to have a fixed U over T.
Yeah.
What is the heating rate one gets? And that will saturate pretty quickly. Uh-huh. You say add a fixed U over T and the lattice gets shallower, yes. And so on. So you can't compare it the fixed lattice depth, but it should be the fixed U over T.
But you can reduce the heating still substantially over what you see in these particular experiments. Yeah. You can reduce the heating yes. here by a substantial factor over what you have in these experiments.
It would be nice to see what one can achieve in experiments.
What was the problem? Was that blue? So it was one blue and two red. Was it that the blue was too close to the red? So what is the problem?
No, it's quite
the red is close.
It's getting away from the red.
The red, yeah.
Excuse me, Matthias. So that curve corresponds to a change of temperature by how much? From left to the right?
That curve.
If we take any one of those, entropy per particle is changed by a factor of three. What's that change in temperature correspond to?
What?
2 or 3 times.
Oh, it's a factor of 10. Yeah.
Factor of
10.
These are boson, so it's
more. It's boson, yeah.
Right?
White cube.
Entropy. Oh, sorry, maybe.
No, it's entropy
goes like T cubed. For a
no, it's mostly the perimeter, which is almost a classical gas.
Ah, yeah. It's mostly in the thermal.
Yes. Quite a bit, and to quite high temperatures compared to a D wave RVB state in the fermions, if we aim for that.
I'm sorry, but this is a Bose condensed, right? So,
yes.
So I don't think...
In the center. But the center is a tiny volume fraction. Uh-huh. There's a huge cloud around it.
So the Lyapunov theory is useless for this entropy estimate. It's classical. It's classical.
Yes, but we can do the Monte Carlo and say, okay, with this entropy per particle, what's the temperature? And then we can tell you for Monte Carlo. Now, if you then look at the phase diagram with the density in the center set by the Monte Carlo logger giving you the total particle number and with the temperature given from the entropy matching by Monte Carlo, it agrees pretty well. And so I say the experimentalists claim that one can use that to map out phase diagrams has been checked and validated and it works. And that's great news because it was non-trivial to get there. There's so many things one has to take into account. And we had big discussions, so that I'm running way over time, and the question is whether I should continue a little bit more or whether I should stop. If nobody runs out, then I continue, because it's great that we talk and discuss here.
No, I don't know.
A little bit.
You should continue a little more, but not, let's say, 1 hour.
No. I will not. 20 minutes. Yeah. Okay. So, 15 minutes. Yes. We can check that also to do more. Like there was a proposal by Jason Ho's group that one could directly measure the temperature just by looking at the density fluctuations in situ pictures by looking at, by comparing on the one hand the density gradient and relating that to the fluctuations of the density. And that's, and the nice thing about the scheme is that if it works, it is universal and works for any system, any phase. And that would be a great way to measure the temperature. And so we tried that in Monte Carlo. And what we did in Monte Carlo, we did thousands and more. So here, I think that picture was for 1,000 independent measurements of the density profile. And you see it gives you a perfectly smooth, with essentially no errors curve. Great density profiles, really measured extremely accurately. And if you then use this equation to calculate the gradient and to calculate the fluctuations, you get horribly noisy data like this. And with 1,000 measurements, you can estimate the temperature to a factor of 2, if you're lucky. If you go to 10,000 measurements, then it works out and the scheme actually does seem to work. Although there are some doubts around, but the scheme works pretty well if you just measure large enough, the long enough. But one can improve schemes, and that's what my student Tamar did with Lode. And we said, okay, why should we look at the fluctuations over a long distance if at the temperature just we are at the correlation length is short? Most of the noise comes from the correlations here at long distance, which is just noise. There is no correlation, but there's lots of noise. So if we reduce this here to just a small window of range, just the correlation length of the density, then the noise gets much less. And that's what one can try. And then with 20 measurements, one gets the temperature to a few percent. So that shows how the Monte Carlo can be used then to check ideas and improve them. You can do that before the experimentalists build a big system, because that was the quick and easy calculation. We need about 20 measurements for an accuracy of 10%. And then one question is that in the experiment, the total particle number is fixed when it's not a grand canonical simulation. And so the question was, does it really work if now the particle number is fixed, but it fluctuates around? And one can try this. And we found that if one averages shots where the particle number doesn't differ by more than 3%, then it still works. If the shots you measure differ in density by more than 3%, then it starts getting dangerous. But it does surprisingly work pretty well.
Is this definition of temperature the same temperature everywhere?
Yeah. That's assumed because that's, yeah. Yeah, it is.
But there is one more assumption which I don't understand. The derivation is based on fluctuations in the grand canonical ensemble.
Yes.
But shot-to-shot experiments are not done from the grand.
But you look at this small window here, which is a small subsection in
chemical potential.
Yes.
Shot is a different chemical potential.
That's why. Yes. So that there will be an error from there, and we estimated that if the fluctuation of that is less than 3% in the total particle number, then it works.
How did you check that?
We changed the chemical potentials
randomly,
averaged it, tested, and saw, okay, how far can we change it? So it works if you control it to that accuracy, then it's fine, to 10%.
Which practically means you post select.
Yes, exactly. You post select. Yes. Now, fermions. That's hard because for fermions, that's where Monte Carlo is harder. That's where we have a sign problem. The sign problem comes that when we want to do the Monte Carlo, we have to map the partition function to a classical sum. When we take a class of states, kind of word line configurations, for example, we have some weights here of the classical system. from the fermions, and to exchange the weight can become negative. We have negative weights, and that's the problem. The basic problem isn't the negative weight itself, but that when we sample it, we have to take the absolute value. And then what we do effectively is we simulate some kind of bosons and want to learn about fermions. And that just doesn't work in a brute force way. So one has to change it from a signed problem to a signed blessing, as Nikolai suggested. One has to find some way to work around that. And fortunately, in the temperature range of current experiments, we have a few methods that work. So we need to think hard. We have to find new ways to simulate fermions. But until there's a flexible, generic, fast, and cheap quantum simulator that can do any model, we're not out of business. That's the great news for me. So I think I can still work on that until I retire. And in the experiment, do you think that within 25 years you will have a quantum simulator for plutonium?
For what?
The plutonium metal, yeah. So there are some things we can still do. So now, in the current experimental regime with the temperature that's about the Hopping or larger, a high temperature series expansion actually works perfectly beautifully well. It's a closed form analytic expression for all thermodynamic quantities, even in the trap and all. For lower temperatures, we can use methods, that will be talked by Nikolai or Boris. And what we did, we used the cluster versions of dynamic field theory, which currently work faster. I don't know yet whether they're intrinsically faster, whether they're faster because they're better optimized. What we did when we compared two experiments of the group of the Esslinger, we used the high temperature expansion. And here we fit the dependence of the particle number, sorry, the dependence of the double occupancy on the particle number to the high temperature series, and that way we could extract the temperature, which is about 15 per cent of the Fermi energy, and we got out the entropy. And the entropies are of the order of 1.6 to 2 kb per particle.
Yeah? Can I make a remark on the entropy? So you will see that the entropy is higher for lower U. And we think that this is related to, I think, Bill's question that when you start loading the lattice, yeah, you have big problems with adiabaticity. Mm-hmm. And my feeling is that the low values of U are even worse in that case than higher, yeah, values of U. But it's not clear, there are different opinions.
Because there's more of a metal here, it's more of a mod state already, so it, yeah.
What are these colors here? It's lower and up and down that we have.
Yes. The balance.
So you measure the temperature before doing the experiment and after doing the experiment? Mm-hmm.
And now you can see where is the nail state, because that's our goal, the next one. We want to cool it down to the nail temperature, and here kind of 1.6 is the entropy we can reach. And we can look at some cuts through the system at various U. Let's look at the large U here, for example. That's the density profile in green. There's the mod phase, and then it drops down. And this is the entropy profile. And the entropy here was still about 1.6 or so. And the nail entropy in the Heisenberg model is about 1/2 of log 2. It's about a factor of 3 smaller in the center. But now the question is, when we cool it further, we want to reach the nail state in the center, but we don't need to have the entropy per particle of the nail entropy, because maybe in the center the entropy drops faster than outside, because the shells outside could capture more entropy. So if we're lucky, we can survive with the higher entropy per particle, but what is the number that one has to achieve? Is it close to 1/2 log 2, or is it close to 1.6, or where is it? The high temperature series will not work to lower temperatures. We're just lucky that it works for the experiments. To go lower, we need a new method. We used the dynamic mean field theory. That's, in the naive way, an approximation. We take the system, we take the lattice, we look at one side only, and we replace the rest by the mean field path. The local side one treats exactly, the atoms hop from the side into the path and back, and we have a density of your states for the path that is yourself consistently. Now that's an approximation that will not give you accurate results, and we want to have really good results. And so what one can do then to make it better, one can actually use a cluster version of it. What dynamical mean field theory does is it makes an approximation on the momentum dependence of the self-energy. The single site method just assumes it is totally momentum independent, completely flat. But you can make some case-based tiling, for example, that's called the DCA method, and have the self-energy be constant in each of these tiles. And as we let the number of tiles go to infinity, the method becomes exact. So as we extrapolate in the cluster size, if that works, then we get accurate results.
Matthias, could you explain me? Because my knowledge of numerical methods is very modest. But I learned from some people, maybe wrongly, but I think correctly, that DMFT in its simplest form would work perfectly for infinite dimensional systems.
For fermions in infinite dimension, it works perfectly because there's no momentum space structure, because every particle is connected to every other.
Related to the fact that DMFT momentum independent self-energy.
Yes, correct.
Okay, so
that works in infinity only. But you cannot do a systematic one over D expansion around that. But you can do this case-based tiling and cross-graining.
Okay.
Let me show some examples, and then more will be shown in the talk by Manuel Gould next month. Here we extrapolate the energy as a function of the cluster size. The extrapolation looks beautiful. We have to go to clusters of size about 64 or so, then it goes really well, and the extrapolated result decreases with the methods at half filling, where we can compare. This method works also away from half filling, where there's a sign problem. On those cluster sizes, the sign problem is not big enough yet to cause a problem, and we can do accurate estimates for the thermodynamic quantities. And here's a picture from Manuel Gould's latest paper. He's the expert who can really push DCA to the biggest systems. He can look at systems with 100 K points. And clusters with 100 sites, he would trust that maybe already without any DCA around it.
Do I understand well that on the cluster you are essentially exact?
Yes.
So he's exact, so he does exactly
a case-based cluster
of this 100 sites plus exact with the path and then some.
Essentially, it's comparable to doing the quantum Monte Carlo exact on 100 sites, but not a real-space cluster, but this case-based cluster, which then has smoother boundary conditions and has smoother the extrapolations. And what you can see here is the self-energy, the real part and the imaginary part. The straight line here is just DMFT that's constant. And this is the structure one gets on a 100-site cluster. There's no way that the constant can really be very accurate. Or the 18 even is approximate. But once you go to about 80 or 100-site cluster, then it starts converging. And that's when you can start trusting this method as an accurate method, not just an approximation.
Do you know how many cosines you would need
with 100? You have about 100?
How many cosines?
Cosines?
cosines, how
many k points you need? I think that's about what it is. This is just cosines. So.
But it seems the real part you get like with one cosine, but the imaginary part maybe.
This you get with one?
No, but why you have to look from 0, 0, 0 to pi, because it takes different directions.
Okay, yeah, but okay, here and here there's something. So you might need maybe two in each direction. Then it's about 8 or 10. But the 18 side cluster, which has 18 kind of cosines, like, as you said, that gives you qualitatively the same, but you have to match more than just one direction, but it's the full 3D structure you have to capture. There's a temperature around the nail temperature. When you go to higher temperatures, then you can work with fewer. But at the nail temperature in 3D already, you need 100 k points. That tells you something that DCA can work. It also tells you what to think maybe about single site results. But we cannot do these big clusters. It needs new algorithms, new implementations, the biggest the machines in the world, but it can be done. Now we can calculate for U up to 12, for the temperatures up to the nail temperature, the energy, the entropy, densities, the double occupancies, the spin correlations, and the numbers are all in the auxiliary material of this preprint. To access auxiliary material for an archive paper, there's a feature that is not documented. You have to download the source table. In the source table, they usually remove everything that's not part of the paper, except anything you put into a folder called AUX. What you put in there stays in the table. So you can include tables and data and so on with an archive paper. And that's where you have all the numbers that you can then use to compare your simulations, your mean field theories, experiments, and whatever. Let me just, to end, show two results. One is the entropy profiles at the U over T of 8 through a typical experimental system as you lower the temperature. And one can estimate that the entropy you need per particle to reach the nail cell in the center is about 0.65. So it's higher than what one wants, but it's still quite a bit below the 1.6 or so that we have now.
On your particular trap, it's not universal somehow.
It does not very much as long as the trap is harmonic.
This is LDA, you know.
And in LDA,
yeah. You can change as much as you want of this coefficient of the trap.
But when you change your trap shape, you might be able to push that up a bit.
Yeah, if you make some parts linear, you can do that.
Yes. Mm-hmm. So one could now use that to optimize the trap shape. You're doing it, yes. Who?
The
DCS, okay. And then see. Okay, then, or then the question is, what is the best way to have the experimenters know what is the temperature? For that one, it's a thermometer. A thermometer is just a quantity you can measure that depends sensitively on the temperature. In this temperature regime, the most sensitive quantity that can still be measured easily is the nearest neighbor, the spin correlation function. That depends quite strongly on the temperature, and that is the best way to measure the temperature here. So let me now finish, because we had lots of discussion and I'm way over time. We can simulate the current experiments in an app initial way. We can use that to validate the experiments. We can use that for thermometry, use it to test new ideas, and use it to tell the experimentalists how hard it will be to reach the next goal. And there I want to stop.
As you know, there's been a lot of controversy over how to interpret experimental results from these hot insulator experiments, the things that are supposed to be simulated in those Hubbard model. And for example, some experimentalists have looked at things like the contrast of the fringes. We looked at the condensate fraction instead. And some people, some theorists, in particular, Nadine Trivedi, criticized the experiments because of the fact that we were looking at peaks, and she was saying, well, these peaks can occur even when you don't have any
that it works with the peaks, for example.
Yeah, so what I was wondering was, given all of this, what you showed us mainly was fitting exactly what the experiments see, but do you have any insights as a result of that as to what ways of looking at the data can tell you, for example, when you're going to? And I can see that that Nikolai wants to answer my question.
Well, we have a paper answering your question fully. If you look for the superfluid normal transition, of course momentum distributions are far better than anything else. You address the order parameter field.
Sure, but which
and part, I mean,
peak height, peak width,
and then we have a full discussion and the derivation and the formulas explaining that, well, you do not just look at the momentum distribution, you analyze it.
Yeah.
Obviously, the correlation.
You certainly agree with that.
But that's what some people in a higher don't understand, that you don't just look at the data, you analyze the data. Yeah. They just say you have peaks in the normal state, and so what? Yes, you understand correlation length diverges from the normal side, it gets bigger and bigger and bigger, you have peaks on the normal side.
Yeah, of course.
But the bimodal structures, the way how they develop when the superfluid transition starts happening in the middle. If you analyze the shape of the peak, you can analyze it in such a way that the signal is crying. TC is here.
Yeah.
Yes, you have peaks on the normal side, you have peaks on the superfluid side, but the way how the shape of the peak is developing.
Well, that's
crying
exactly
for the critical
like
point.
What we did, so I'm very happy to hear
this. Yeah, so it's crying for the critical point. Even in the strongly correlated regime, there is a way to analyze the peak in such a way it says critical point is here. Of course, with the accuracy which is given by the size of the trap.
Sure.
Obviously, this is a limitation.
Yeah. So
looking at where this starts, essentially, that's where TC is.
So where? I mean,
you look at these peaks.
No answer.
Okay.
Yeah.
Well, I can describe the protocol of just analyzing the image, which will say where TC happens.
Yeah.
I mean, you could pick on the normal side, sure.
The way we did it was we fit to a bimodal distribution, just what you're what you're saying.
No, not the right way. No, just we have an expression how you have to be done, and we can prove that's how it will work.
Okay, we'll talk some more then.
Freedom fitting.
Yeah, there's no fit, you will just see a sharp minimum at the transition point.
Okay.
From some point.
The BCA calculation.
Yes.
Do you have any feeling of what the dependence on the type of lattice you look at would be, like if you would not do that with 3D, say, square, but 2D triangular?
We haven't done it yet, it can be done. But I can't tell you how big clusters you need, at which temperatures.
Physics would be rather different.
The physics will be different, but in the triangular lattice, because you don't have the nail ordering, it might even work well on smaller clusters down to lower temperatures, because you don't have this the emergency, but that's something one would have to do.
It would be harder for triangular lattice DCA because of the sign problem.
Right, I was
so
guessing
it would be harder.
You said it would get simpler.
Because of frustration.
You might need only the smaller clusters.
If the lower in temperature would be.
But going low in temperature is always a problem. So it will get harder because you want to look at much, much lower temperatures, for example. So it really depends on what the exact question is that you ask.
And the type of solver is.
The type of solver is a continuous time auxiliary field method with improved delayed submatrix updates that have another factor of 10. So it's roughly about the factor of 10,000 better than Hirschfei. And then we use big machines.
Could you go to the slide where you were showing what the entropy needed to be to get the nail?
Yep.
Right. So yes. Now the homogeneous system, the entropy per particle should be 0.41.
Yeah. Around here somewhere. Yeah.
And what, if you're in a trap,
yes.
Then so the 0.65 that you're quoting means the entropy averaged over the whole trap.
Yes, correct.
And
then in the center, you'll reach the 0.41.
The 0.41.
Yes.
Okay.
Exactly.
Now, it runs in my mind that during the meeting we had last week, that people were talking about numbers a little bit smaller than 0.41. But maybe somebody will tell me whether my memory is. I was remembering numbers like 0.3.
There's log 2 for the infinite U model. Yeah. It's Heisenberg model.
Yeah.
Yeah. The Heisenberg model is known. That's one of our papers, and there's a paper by Stefan Wessel on that. That was actually part of.
There was something number like 0.345 or something like that, 0.35 or something.
For the Heisenberg limit, for very, very large U. At the U of about 8 to 12, it's higher. That helps you. At large U, it goes down again because then you lose all the charge fluctuations. At the intermediate U, the charge can fluctuate. In addition, it means you have more entropy and you're still in a nail state.
Okay.
That's why it's higher here. So you should not go to the highest U to reach it.
Okay.
But something below that is, I think the lower bound should be that Heisenberg.
If you're interested, there are substantial deviations with what Nandini has shown for these numbers. 10% at least.
Okay.
How substantial you call 10%?
Yes. If you do computations, you want an accurate number. If you do experiments,
if you have 10%. If you have 10% deviation with an error bar that's much smaller, then it's a problem. Mm-hmm. Okay, thank you.